Hi everyone, my name is Sebastian Mader. Today we'll be discussing materials and nanotechnology, specifically an introduction to nanoparticle synthesis and applications. As a general outline, for today we'll discuss different ways to synthesize nanoparticles, such as colloidal chemical methods, attrition, pyrolysis, RF plasma, thermal decomposition, and pulsed laser method. Then we'll discuss a few nanoparticle applications in brief. Colloidal methods. Colloidal chemical methods are some of the most useful, easiest, and cheapest ways to create nanoparticles. Colloidal methods may utilize both organic and inorganic reactants. Typically, a metal salt is reduced, leaving nanoparticles evenly dispersed in a liquid. Aggregation, or the kind of coalescing of the nanoparticles, is prevented by electrostatic repulsion or the introduction of a stabilizing reagent that coats the particle surfaces. Particle sizes can range from 1 to 200 nanometers and are controlled by the initial concentrations of the reactants and the action of the stabilizing reagent. So again, the overall final size of the colloidal nanoparticles depends upon initial concentrations and basically how well the stabilizing reagent does its job. One example is colloidal synthesis of gold. A common method for preparing colloidal gold involves combining hydrogen tetrachlororate and sodium citrate in a dilute solution. Upon disassociation, the citrate ions reduce the gold 3+ to yield 30 to 40 nanometer gold particles. Half reaction equations are shown below. You can see that gold is being reduced by gaining 3 electrons, and the citrate ion is partially oxidized. Here's a little kind of step-by-step picture showing you what's going on. We heat a solution of chlororic acid to the boiling point. It's a water-soluble gold salt. We add some trisodium citrate, which is a reducing agent, once it's been heated. We continue stirring and heated for about 10 minutes. During this time, the sodium citrate reduces the gold salt to metallic gold. The neutral gold atoms aggregate into seed crystals, and the seed crystals continue to grow and eventually form gold nanoparticles. There's also several color changes during this part of the reaction, because as the gold nanoparticles are formed, they change the absorbance spectrum of the solution. And another way to view this synthesis route is we see on the left nucleation of gold seed crystals. They start to agglomerate. And over on the right, seed crystal tens to hundreds of atoms. The growth of nanoparticles from a seed crystal can be isotropic, forming spherical nanoparticles where citrate ions cap the surface, or it may be anisotropic, forming nanorods. Adding surfactant to growth solution caps certain crystal faces and therefore promotes growth only in the non-capped selected directions. Another example is colloidal growth of molybdenum nanoparticles. 1 to 5 nanometer nanoparticles can be created at room temperature by reducing molybdenum trichloride in a toluene solution in the presence of sodium triethyl borohydride. Reaction equation is shown below. Another example is that of iron. The TEM image to the right shows 3 nanometer iron nanoparticles produced by reducing iron 2 chloride with sodium borohydride in xylene. Topo was introduced as a capping agent to prevent oxidation and aggregation, much in the same way as citrate acted in the synthesis of the gold nanoparticles. And TEM is tunneling electron microscopy. One more example is silver. Reduction of silver nitrate by sodium borohydride in aqueous solution can produce small diameter silver nanoparticles. In one method, the reduction takes place between layers of kaolinite, a layered silicate clay material that functions to limit the particle growth. Dimethyl sulfoxide, or DMSO, is used as a capping agent to prevent corrosion and aggregation of the silver nanoparticles. Another form of nanoparticle synthesis is attrition. Attrition is very different. It's actually a mechanical method for creating certain types of nanoparticles. The way it works is macro or micro scale particles are ground in a ball mill. planetary ball mill, or some other size-reducing mechanical tool. The resulting particles are separated by filters and recovered. The particle sizes range from tens to hundreds of nanometers, and there's a very broad size distribution and varied particle geometry. Drawbacks is they may contain defects and impurities from the milling process, and the attrition is generally considered to be very energy intensive. So here's a picture of a rotary ball mill. You basically have a hollow steel cylinder containing some tungsten balls and a solid precursor which rotates about its axis. Particle size is reduced by brittle fracturing resulting from ball-ball and ball-wall collisions, and the milling takes place in an inert gas atmosphere to reduce contamination. Some examples of attrition are shown below, where we have different powders or precursor materials which are being produced by attrition, whether it's a rotary ball mill, vibratory mill, etc. And then we have a typical grain size and attrition time, the time it takes to get our kind of final nanoparticle results. As you can see, if you look at the amount of time required for some of these methods, it's clearly a very energy-intensive synthesis route. Another type of nanoparticle synthesis is pyrolysis. So for pyrolysis, we'll discuss a little bit about its history, system overview, aggregation and agglomeration, the impact of oxygen flow, jet design, flame quenching, and specifically nozzle quenching or electrostatic charging. So as you might have guessed, we're talking about flames, fire, and lysis splitting. Material applications of nanoparticles produced by pyrolysis. These particles can be found in tires, paints, optical fibers, makeup, and inks. Many other materials as well. The annual production of flame-made materials, or materials made by flame pyrolysis, are huge. Carbon black, 8 million tons. Titanium dioxide, 2.5 million tons. And silicon dioxide, 2 million tons a year. A little bit of history. Here we see an advertisement back in 1949 for silicon dioxide nanoparticles. Carbon black department. Here's a picture of the Chanel plant in the Texas Panhandle in the 1940s. Basically, using gas and flame pyrolysis to produce kind of a soot, which was the carbon black used for many rubbers and kind of tire products. So pyrolysis is a popular method for creating nanoparticles, especially oxides. A precursor, typically liquid or gas, is forced through an orifice at high pressures and burned. The resulting ash is collected to recover the nanoparticles. A large volume of gas leads to high rate of material synthesis. So here's what it looks like. Flame spray pyrolysis is very versatile. There's a large variety of precursors. It's highly controllable and highly scalable. If we look on the right, we see that basically a liquid fuel is brought in. We have some oxygen. There we also have some methane and oxygen being produced. There are several stages throughout the flame. We have droplet evaporation, nucleation, coagulation, condensation, and then finally aggregation, all occurring within the spray flame. Here's a system overview. On the left, we have a vacuum pump providing some cooling to the collecting filter. We have the flame below where we'll have a feed gas and oxygen. Over on the right, we have nitrogen carrier gas, some spray, a precursor solution, and an ultrasonic vibrator. So let's discuss aggregates and agglomerates. An aggregate is an assemblage of particles rigidly joined together by chemical or sinter forces. But an agglomerate is a loosely coherent assembly of particles and or aggregates held together by weak interactions. Current aerosol instruments actually cannot distinguish between the two. So again, aggregates rigidly joined together while agglomerates are loosely connected. This picture shows the agglomerate formation sequence. If we look on the left, we see titanium dioxide monomers. Then they become harder agglomerates. We get spherical particles, larger hard agglomerates, and finally soft agglomerates. And this is going from left to right with increasing residence time, which basically means more time within the flame. The degree of agglomeration actually matters. If the nanoparticles produced by pyrolysis are highly agglomerated, they're typically used in fillers, catalysts, as light guide preforms, and particles for CMP. It's chemical mechanical planarization. Non-agglomerated particles are often used in pigments, composites, and electronics. The distinction between hard and soft agglomerates is largely empirical. Therefore, controlled agglomeration is important, and it can minimize post-grinding and other costly separation techniques. Here again, we see a depiction of the regions of agglomeration and how particle area concentration varies with residence time. At the bottom, we can see at higher residence times, we tend to have more larger soft agglomerates. At lower residence times, we tend to have non-agglomerates. And that'll also vary with the particle area concentration. The effect of oxidant flow on flame. Here's silica producing a flame. What we see is various oxygen flow rates down at the bottom, and then the flame size. Oxygen also has a significant impact on pyrolysis. It aids in combustion. It provides the chemistry needed for the reaction to occur. It also acts as a dilutant and cools the flame, somewhat preventing agglomeration. All of these variables can be decoupled by burner design, which is actually cheaper than increasing oxygen flow. In other words, though we can change these properties by increasing oxygen flow, it actually makes more sense economically to change the design of the burner itself. Here we're looking at a graph of particle size controlled by oxygen flow. On the x-axis at the bottom, we can see the oxygen flow rate in liters per minute. And on the left, we have basically the equivalent particle diameter. Excess oxygen makes the flame burn cooler, which actually results in smaller diameter particles. So as you see, as we go to the right, 10, 15, 20, 25 liters per minute of oxygen, we're getting significantly smaller and smaller nanoparticle diameters. Particle formation and growth by gas phase chemical reaction, coagulation, sintering, and surface growth. So this picture is showing some molecules interacting with oxygen to form titanium dioxide molecules, then particles, then finally TiO2 aggregates as they are carried upwards towards the lower temperature regions of the flame. Again, we discussed the importance of the jet design in pyrolysis. It's more efficient, more economical to change the jet design rather than significantly increasing the levels of oxygen flow. If you look at the top, you see different sized nanoparticles from 10 all the way up to 100 nanometers, really being changed just by nozzle design. And we can change the different gases we bring in or the actual location of the gases or the nozzles at the bottom of the flame. This figure depicts the effect of oxidant composition on titanium dioxide morphology. The figure on the left shows one type of flame mixing, and the figure on the right shows a different type of flame mixing or different nozzle designs, and depicting that we can get different sized nanoparticles just by changing the design of the nozzle. So nozzle quenching is also an important concern in pyrolysis. The flame length is actually controlled by rapid quenching. What this does is prevents agglomeration by inhibiting growth processes in the early stages of growth. This provides precise control of particle size. So basically, if we allow a long residence time, we'll get larger and larger kind of agglomerates. But if we quench the flame earlier, we can kind of dictate a smaller size of particles produced. Nozzle quenching, therefore, controls the flame length and, therefore, the particle size. The figure in the top right, we can see that basically we're quenching the flame at various heights. The figure at the on the left shows an expansion nozzle on top of the burner, which we could move to various heights to quench the flame and therefore control flame length and particle size. This graph depicts titanium dioxide particle size being controlled by nozzle quenching. So you can see that as the nozzle distance increases all the way up to 5 centimeters on the right, the equivalent particle diameter increases. So that makes sense. The closer the nozzle, the less residence time, and therefore the smaller the particles. The greater the distance between the nozzle, the further the particles flow, basically, through the flame, and therefore they have more time to kind of cool and agglomerate. Another important factor to consider in flame pyrolysis is electrostatic charging. Particle size can also be controlled by generating an electric field across the flame. A large electric field, typically hundreds of kilovolts per meter, is generated between two plate electrodes situated on opposite sides of the flame. Similar to nozzle quenching, the electric field limits particle growth by reducing the residence time in the high temperature region of the flame. In addition, the electric field charges the particles. This results in electrostatic repulsion between newly formed particles, preventing coagulation. So the effect of electrostatic charging is very similar to nozzle quenching, though it's done in a unique manner. Here we see the effect on pyrolysis due to electrostatic charging. On the left, we see nanoparticles formed without an electric field. On the right, we have nanoparticles formed with an electric field. And this is the evolution of titanium dioxide particle growth with and without applied electric fields. Overall, on the right, we can see much smaller nanoparticles synthesized by use of electrostatic charging. Advantages and disadvantages of flame pyrolysis. Pyrolysis is a high-yield method that can fulfill the strong demand for nanoparticles. It can be customized to produce unique nanoparticles, but a broad distribution of particle sizes and morphologies may occur. Another nanoparticle synthesis route is RF plasma. The starting material is placed in a pestle and heated under vacuum by RF heating coils. A high-temperature plasma is created by flowing a gas, such as helium, through the system in the vicinity of the coils. When the material is heated beyond its evaporation point, the vapor nucleates on the gas atoms, which diffuse up to a cooler collector rod and form nanoparticles. The particles can then be passivated by introducing another gas, such as oxygen. In the case of aluminum nanoparticles, the oxygen forms a thin layer of aluminum oxide around the outside of the particle, inhibiting aggregation and agglomeration. RF plasma synthesis is a very popular method for creating ceramic nanoparticles and powders, but it has a low yield. Here's a diagram of an RF plasma apparatus. At the bottom, we have the evacuated chamber, helium gas inlet. We see a container that would hold our metal, the RF coils, which would heat the material, and then the collector rod, which would be cooled and cause condensation and agglomeration of our nanoparticles. Thermal decomposition is another type of nanoparticle synthesis. This is a chemical decomposition of a substance into its constituents by supplying heat. A solid bulk material is heated beyond its decomposition temperature in an evacuated furnace tube. The precursor material may contain metal cations and molecular anions or metal organic solids. An example is taking lithium nitride and decomposing it to form solid lithium and nitrogen gas. The lithium particles can be synthesized by heating lithium nitride in a quartz tube under vacuum. When heated to 375 degrees Celsius, the nitrogen simply outgasses from the bulk material and the lithium atoms coalesce to form the metal nanoparticles. This is a simple decomposition reaction. So here's the general diagram for a thermal decomposition apparatus. The system, again, has to be evacuated, so it's under vacuum. We're doing that with a turbomolecular pump, which is backed by a mechanical pump, basically using a quartz tube, and we have heated coils around it acting as a furnace, and then we have our sample. The final method of nanoparticle synthesis that we're going to discuss is the pulsed laser method. Pulsed lasers have been employed in the synthesis of silver nanoparticles from silver nitrate solutions. Basically, a disc rotates in this solution while a laser beam is pulsed onto the disc, creating hot spots. Silver nitrate is reduced, forming silver nanoparticles. The size of the particle is controlled by the energy in the laser and the speed of the rotating disc. Here's a diagram showing pulsed laser apparatus for silver nanoparticles. We have the pulsed laser beam coming in from the top, rotating disc substrate is below, and nanoparticles are formed on this disc, which is all placed within solution, depending upon basically the interaction time between the laser and the surface of the disc. So now that we have all these different synthesis routes for nanoparticles, let's discuss a few nanoparticle applications. One example is zinc oxide. Zinc oxide has opaque and antifungal properties. So it's used as a UV blocking pigment in sunscreens, cosmetics, varnishes, and fabrics. It's also incorporated in foot powders and garden supplies as an antifungal agent. And zinc oxide nanowires can actually improve the elastic toughness of bulk materials as well. Titanium dioxide is another nanoparticle. This is used as an inorganic white pigment for many things such as paper, paints, plastics, and other whitening agents. Titanium dioxide nanoparticles are also used as UV blocking pigments in sunscreens, cosmetics, varnishes, and fabrics. Titanium dioxide has unique photocatalytic properties that make it suitable for a number of advanced applications. Some of these include self-cleaning glass and anti-fog coatings, photoelectrochemical cells, or PECs. They're used in the detoxification of wastewater and also for hydrolysis. Iron is also being used as a nanoparticle. 50 to 100 nanometer iron nanoparticles are used in magnetic recording devices for both digital and analog data. And decreasing the diameter to 30 to 40 nanometers actually increases the magnetic recording capacity by 5 to 10 times per unit. This is a very significant increase in recording capacity by simply decreasing the diameter of these iron nanoparticles. Iron oxide nanoparticles have unique magnetic and optical properties. For example, iron oxide nanoparticles can be translucent to visible light while being opaque to UV light. Thus, applications of iron oxide include UV protective coatings, various electromagnetic uses, electro-optic uses, and uses in data storage. Iron alloys, such as iron platinum nanoparticles, have increased magnetism, and it's predicted that 3 nanometer particles can increase the data storage capacity by 10 times per unit area. Iron palladium nanoparticles, with 100 to 200 nanometer diameters, have been shown to reduce toxic chlorinated hydrocarbons to non-toxic hydrocarbon and chloride compounds. Alumina, or aluminum oxide, is another common metal oxide nanoparticle used in chemical mechanical polishing, or CMP slurries, as well as certain ceramic filters. Nanoalumina is also used in light bulbs and fluorescent tube coatings because they emit light more uniformly and therefore allow for better flow of fluorescent materials. Silver is also a common metal nanoparticle being used currently. Silver has excellent conductivity and has been used as an antimicrobial material for thousands of years. Turns out that silver's antimicrobial potential or effect actually increases with increased surface area, especially relative to its volume. Therefore, applications of silver nanoparticles are becoming very common in biocides, transparent conductive inks, and antimicrobial plastics and bandages. They're also being used in many things such as sports socks, different types of garments, and also in medical and hospital equipment and linens. Gold nanoparticles, as we discussed, are relatively easy to produce compared to other types due to its high chemical stability. The uses for gold nanoparticles are typically catalytic and include DNA detection and the oxidation of carbon monoxide. Gold has superior conductivity, allowing gold nanoparticles to be used in various probes, sensors, and optical applications. One nanoparticle application of gold is actually the first response home pregnancy test. These use 1 micron polystyrene spheres and 50 nanometer gold particles coated with an antibody to human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG. This is a hormone produced during pregnancy. When urine containing HCG comes into contact with the polystyrene gold antibody complex, the nanoparticles coagulate into clumps. These clumps actually appear red. Fluids pass through a filter where the clumps are caught, and they produce a pink color to the filter. The suspended or uncoagulated nanoparticles can pass right through the filter and no color change occurs. So if a female is not pregnant, basically nanoparticles will pass right through the filter with no color change. If she is pregnant or has HCG present, then the antibody complex will coagulate, form into the larger clumps, which appear red, and when they get stuck in the filter, we would see a pink designation, maybe a plus sign or something. Oh, here's a little picture of that. We see the 50 nanometer gold particles coated with the antibody to HCG. We also see the small microspheres. Liquid can flow. We test for agglutination or coagulation, capture them in a filter, and this can be quantified with a reflectometer or a simple strip reader. In the case of the pregnancy test, it's just visually looking at the filter and whether or not we see a pink designation or not. Zirconium dioxide are another form of nanoparticles being used. These can be used to increase the tensile strength of materials when applied as a coating. This has many possible applications in wear coatings, ceramics, dyes, cutting edges, as well as piezoelectric components and dielectrics.